It is time now for our visit with Dr. Michael Parenti, a political economist and, in my opinion, and the opinion of many, opinions of many others, one of the foremost political intellects on the scene this evening. Good evening, Dr. Parenti. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All righty. You are live in front of the KFJC audience.
Okay. Can you hear me? All right.
You're coming in loud and clear. And on behalf of this audience, I want to thank you for taking time out for your busy schedule to visit with us this evening. I know
thank you.
Have many fans in our audience. I thought, actually, I think we're going to take a somewhat different starting point, I think, Dr. Parenti, than what I'd planned and even what I just discussed with you. Next week, from 4 to midnight on the station, I'm going to be doing something which has become an annual tradition here at KFJC, or become a tradition. Every Memorial Day, I do extensive programming about the connections between U.S. industry and finance and the fascist powers of Europe. Unfortunately, history, or perhaps mishistory, has recorded the rise of fascism as an aberration. A little man with a pencil, toothbrush, mustache hypnotized all the Germans and made them all go crazy. And then along came the Allies and knocked off the bad old fascists, and everybody lived happily ever after, or they would have. But along came another bad man named Joseph Stalin, who hypnotized all the Russians and made them all go crazy, etc. What relevance do you see in the study of fascism, perhaps as a political economist?
Well, I guess I see fascism as something very closely linked to the crises in capitalism. And I think you've, by the way, done some very good programs on this. And you're absolutely right that especially much of the literature after the 1940s, well into the 50s, 60s, 70s, has emphasized fascism as an irrational movement. Much of the television treatment also just shows these guys goose-stepping and Sieg Heiling and all. And it was all that. There was occult themes. There were themes of blood purity and all that sort of stuff. But fascism had a very rational side. By rational, I mean it served the interests of some very real people. It's not only who supported it. It was not only that big business supported fascism. It's who the Nazis supported when they came into power. Not only who supported them, but whom they supported. And they, when you had the crisis of capitalism, fascism is an attempt at a final solution to the class struggle. They destroyed the trade unions. They destroyed all the left political parties and even the centrist and moderately progressive parliamentary groups. They destroyed any kind of political democracy. They cut the inheritance taxes for the rich. They cut wages drastically by half. And this is true also in Italy as well as Germany. Profits increased tremendously. And the German cartels actually even became complicit in the worst crimes. Not only did they look the other way and give Hitler support and money under the table, but it reached the point where you had the major industries in Germany using slave labor from the concentration camps. I mean, working people to death. And so the profits were immense. I mean, when you no longer have to pay workers 3 marks an hour or something, and you get them freed, you know, just for a little thin bowl of gruel at the end of the day. You even had people like Krupp and I.G. Fagan calling Farben, I.G. Farben, I guess, making special requests that new labor camps be built near their other factory outlets so that they could have ready access to cheap labor. So this is the way I see fascism. It's ultimately in the service of capitalism. And much of U.S. intervention throughout the Third World is the same thing. I mean, under the guise of fighting communism, they say they're fighting communism and saving democracy when they're really helping fascism to save capitalism.
Well, if we could step back in time, there are a number of takeoff points in your remarks, Dr. Parenti, the ones you've just made that could perhaps serve as thesis statements for long paths of inquiry. But if we could step back in time now, and one of the things that I wanted to pursue from your comment was your reference to a crisis in capitalism. Of course, the Second World War and the liquidations of all of the people that resulted from, were part and parcel to that conflict. Those events followed on the Great Depression. And the Great Depression was, of course, a worldwide phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
I read into your comments, perhaps correctly, perhaps incorrectly, that when you talk about the crisis of capitalism, that with regard to the rise of fascism prior to and during the Second World War, that was the crisis you were referring to. More specifically, how...
Generally, yeah.
Yeah. How would you equate, or how would you relate the rise of fascism with the Great Depression?
Well...
Or would you, or am I incorrect there?
Well, it was a number of things. It was the crises of German and Italian capitalism vis-a-vis their English and French and other Western European competitors. It was the falling rate of profit they were enduring. You see, one thing Mussolini did in Italy and Hitler did in Germany was they said there was a crisis and there was a threat, and they named communism, the mm-hmm. left, you know, that these people are threatening us and they're going to take over. But the left was really never that powerful in either of those countries to actually seize state power. But there was a crisis. It wasn't from the Bolsheviks and the communists or the Jews or this group or that group. It was from within the system itself. It had these enormous contradictions, a falling rate of profit, consumption going down. Especially heavy industry was in crisis, looking for new exports, imports, all sorts of protections. And what people on the left and what the Jews became were a convenient, irrelevant but convenient enemy on which to blame these things. The Germans knew they were getting ripped off by the cartels, but if they moved against German capitalism, they would be moving in a genuinely revolutionary direction. And instead, they were told, well, you know, it's these other people. It's the trade unionists who are doing it. It's the communist trade unionists. It's the Masons. It's the Versailles allies who put this terrible treaty on us. It's this group. It's that group. And behind all of them, there's the Jew, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they fashioned, if you look at Nazi propaganda, it wasn't all that irrational. You know, Hermann Göring made a very good point. He said, if we are lunatics, then lunacy becomes us. And there's the other old saying that, you know, they may have been crazy, but they weren't stupid. Their propaganda to the farmers stressed the usurious rates that they had to pay, and they said the Jews were behind that. Their propaganda to the workers, they said, oh, it's the rich Jewish bankers behind you. Their propaganda to the small business people was, it's the big Jewish department store owners and all those people. And so their propaganda to the middle class was that it was the Jewish trade union guys who were getting all this money for the union workers, and you're getting squeezed in the middle. So they very much honed their appeals to conjure up these irrelevant enemies and to direct hostility and attention that way, just as a George Bush running a Willie Horton ad and hitting on affirmative action and on quota systems and that sort of thing is trying to direct people's very real grievances. I mean, people have very real grievances about the system, including Bubba and Joe Redneck and Archie Bunker. They have very real, they too are getting ripped off and all, and to direct those things at the blacks, the Jews, the welfare chiselers, so we have a lot of those same kinds of themes and techniques operating here. We have a kind of Nazism without the swastika. Huey Long was right. He said if fascism ever came to America, it will come under the name of Americanism, super patriotism and all.
One of the things that struck me as you were analyzing the macroeconomic forces behind the rise of fascism the first time around, one of the things that struck me was the similarity with some of the things that are going on today.
Really?
But let's start economically. Many of the things that you spoke about, falling profits, for example,
mm-hmm.
many of the same conditions are afflicting American industry, and beyond that, an awful lot of the Western industrial capacity, even in the Asian nations
mm-hmm.
as well.
Cutting the income taxes on the big corporations, cutting inheritance taxes for the rich. I mean, Reagan was doing these same things that Mussolini and Hitler did, really.
Indeed, a program, and this is, I believe, one that was sent to you by a listener.
Breaking the labor unions, doing the same thing.
Right. I did a comparison in one of the programs I'm going to be airing next week, Uncle
uh-huh.
Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State, in which I compared many of the key features of Mussolini's corporate state with the American political economy under Reagan and Bush,
mm-hmm.
or political and economic situation.
Well, that'll be worth the price of that tape, I can tell you. That's an important analysis to make. Yeah.
It is, unfortunately, and I
don't want
was
you to
wrong.
Steal your own thunder, but you want to go into it now, be my guest.
All righty. Well, we're going to be going into that at greater length. What I wanted to ask, since my listeners get a chance to listen to me hold forth at great length, and I usually fail to I usually don't disappoint in that regard, what do you think, well, I perhaps shouldn't ask you to look into a crystal ball, But given some of the similarities with the crisis in capitalism that produced or led to the rise of fascism last time around, do you feel that that is a realistic concern today? And where do you see things going, both with regard to the crisis in capitalism itself and with regard to the solutions, hopefully not a final solution, but the solutions that will be found to that by the powers that be?
Well, what I predicted over a year ago is that we were witnessing the third worldization of the United States. And I just came across a quote by a CEO from a big corporation. I don't have it handy right now, but he said that until we can get labor costs down to what it is in places like Brazil and South Korea, don't expect to be sharing in the benefits of increased productivity. I mean, that's saying it. That's Brazil, South Korea, wow. They really have plans. And when they talk about going global, a global economy, they mean that the poor workers in the third world who are made to compete, you know, for a pittance, for starvation wages, are now will be in open competition with American workers. And what we're seeing is all the good quality blue-collar jobs have been pretty much wiped out. The possible exception being defense. I mean, defense is probably one of the last places where you can still get a really good-paying blue-collar job, which is why the impact is being felt so well. And there's an awful lot of coverage on TV showing defense workers out and can we do this and all that. And I kept saying to myself, gee, they didn't put those daycare workers in those hospitals. The public hospitals have closed down, and those health workers and the librarians from the libraries they're closing, doesn't seem much sympathy for them. But in any case, what you're getting is this kind of third worldization, increase in underemployment, upwards of over, I think it's over a third of the U.S. workforce now. The ones who have jobs are working as what are called casuals or temps or adjuncts or dailies, you know, which is contracted workers who have no benefits, will work from day to day. It's like one big waterfront shape-up, you know. You don't know if you're going in or not. And who generally don't even get 40 hours a week. And so you're getting a labor unions have been broken and the like. So I would say they may be able to keep the democratic political framework intact, but they are certainly changing the class structure so that the working class is really being depressed more heavily. Very much, again, doing that, they'll do it in different countries in different ways. In some countries, they'll bust the labor unions with death squads. They go in and shoot the, you know, systematically and repeatedly shoot the labor leaders and all that, like places like El Salvador and such.
Mm-hmm.
In this country, they bust the labor unions with the Taft-Hartley law, with impossible organizing strictures, with the court injunctions and those kinds of things. So it's done somewhat differently. The methods may be a little more benign, but the whole goal is to really make sure that a larger and larger portion of the gross national income goes to the top 1 or 2% of the population, which is exactly what's been happening. There may be depression and there may be losses in wages and earning power for millions of people, but the very top people are richer than ever. They're making more and more money than ever. So that's my crystal ball. It's not so much that our political rights will be threatened, but our political rights become increasingly irrelevant. I mean, what the hell is the use that I could talk about this or that or vote for Giorgio Billy? I mean, if these guys are going to be sticking it to us anyway. So this is the kind of the thing we're facing. On the other hand, we have to mobilize. We have to do some things. I think Clinton is not Bush. It's not quite the same, although he's certainly close enough. And that on some, for instance, we are now, right now, mobilizing to get changes in the existing labor laws so that one could organize a shop by going in and just having sign-up check cards, you know, which is the way you can do it in Canada or a place like Sweden. And in Sweden, you got 80% of the population are in labor unions, and it actually does help their standard of living. So these are some of the kind of things we'd be doing in an attempt to fight back.
Dr. Parenti, going back again to the crisis in capitalism and where you see, what I would like to know is where you see that crisis going and what sort of response do you see, do you forecast on the part of our national security establishment, bearing in mind that to a large extent our national security establishment serves as a policy instrument of America's corporate needs, not exclusively so, but to a considerable extent. You were discussing that executive's observations on the third worldization, so to speak, and in opposition to your own observations on the third worldization of America, and you talked about Brazil and South Korea. The state of civil liberties in both of those countries is rather sorry, and I do not think that most Americans would willingly go along with the sorts of social conditions that exist in those countries. Where do you see the crisis in capitalism going? Do you think that, that it is going to be resolved successfully? And if not, where do you see the conflict between American democratic values and the needs of the corporations to solve that crisis?
Well, there's a basic contradiction between capitalism and democracy. I know we're being fed a lot of pap now that free enterprise and political freedom are compatible twins, or they're both necessary conditions for each other, but in fact there are very basic contradictions. The essence of capitalism is to reward people for market accumulation, for competitiveness, for really getting what they can, and to punish or to leave to the dwarves those who cannot run that race. The essence of democracy is that every human being has a worth, even those who maybe cannot perform so successfully, and that there should be an egalitarian rather than an unequal, which is the essence of capitalism, is inequality. So that strain will be there. If the people successfully use democratic means to mobilize to protect their standard of living or win new gains and cut into capitalist profit margins, and in a way deepening the crises in a certain direction, this then often leads to an extension of the attack. No longer do you just attack their standard of living, but you also attack their democratic rights. And by the way, the Reagan administration was fully aware of that. They were doing all that sort of thing, trying to limit the legality of everything from limiting the legality of demonstrations in shopping malls to trying to set up anti-terror laws for those who did solidarity work for Central America, and all those kinds of repressive measures, in which they did not succeed in all of them, but they certainly limiting the access of the Freedom of Information Act and the like. Resolving the question, the crises of capitalism successfully, is a kind of an ambiguous term, because successfully for whom? The road they're going now is for them a great success story. Their successful resolution is to have the American worker competing in utter misery with the Brazilian or South Korean workers, to have the political democracy very limited or marginal, or just the forms of it without too much of the substance, and they're squeezing and squeezing more to maintain their profit margins. It's a basically irrational system, and this is why people who say Marx is no longer relevant have obviously never read Marx, because Marx, first of all, never talked about existing socialism in places like Eastern Europe or Russia, and he had nothing to say about those things. His study was of the laws of capital motion and development, and his great work is called Capital, Capital. And they've also talked about imperialism. And what's happening with capital is that an increasing portion of every investment goes into constant capital, into the technology, the plants, the means of production and such, and much and much less goes into the variable capital, into the labor. The rate of exploitation goes higher because you're hiring less workers who are producing more and more. So finally, what you got to do, what it comes down to is you're investing proportionally more and more capital to get the same or less return. So to make up for that squeeze is you squeeze the only thing that's really flexible there, which is the variable capital, which is the money you pay out in wages to workers. You squeeze them and you make them take cutbacks in benefits. You make them take cutbacks in wages, and you do all the other things I talked about earlier. Put them on temps, and make them into temporary workers. People don't have real jobs anymore. It's amazing the millions of people who don't. You force them to take two jobs. You give them forced overtime, but without time and a half. any number of kinds of things that you do. And that's the way they're, quote, resolving the crises. And the other thing is, as you defeat democratic forces throughout the Third World, you leave those countries in a client-state relationship to the United States, which means that the U.S. multinationals or Japanese or French or German or whatever can go into these countries. There are no labor unions that are, you know, have any kind of strength at all. There's no occupational safety laws. There's no environmental protection laws. Come on in here, take what you want, invest what you want, you know, and no taxes. You have to worry. You don't have to worry about any taxes for 20 years, if ever. And child labor, all the things that we thought we had left behind some generations back, the earlier part of this century, are there in the Third World, maybe never left, and gotten worse as investments gone in there. The condition of people being driven off the land where there was subsistence farming, where they could raise rice and beans for themselves, and that land is turned into cash crop exports for coffee and sugar or you know, cattle for beef. And that's, by the way, no break for us. We hear that well. When they go to cheap markets, they produce cheap commodities, and we get a break on it as consumers. So, well, that's not true. You know, let's take the case of Nike. Nike has closed every single factory they ever had in America. They opened their factories abroad. They now have their major production is in a country called Indonesia, where they pay women 80 cents a day. I mean, they pay them starvation wages. Even the right-wing fascist Indonesian generals have complained that maybe this is a little too low. I read somewhere that something like 70% of the women in the Nike workforce in Indonesia suffer from some degree of malnutrition. The shoes they produce, they bring back stateside, and they sell them for $125, $120, $130 a pair. So it doesn't give us a break, and anyway, I don't want a break if it's going to be all blood and slave labor. But they don't go all the way over there to give you a nicer price on the shoes. They go all the way over there to cut down their labor costs. Any penny they have to pay out in wages is one less penny they're going to get and pocket in profits or in big executive salaries or in big benefits or stock options or private airplanes or all the other perks that they have.
It's interesting that many of the Nike shoes are also the marketing campaigns aim at black and Latino inner city youth to buy these large, to be like Mike, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And so
yeah.
the irony is further, that the situation, I should say, is made even more grotesque. Because of the marketing. By the way, for the benefit of listeners hopefully they will all tune in next week, one of the things I'm going to be discussing, and in fact analyzing in detail next week that I have not had a chance to get to or I have not gotten to in previous years, is Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf in 1931, in which he stated that democracy itself was inherently subversive. He equated it with communism. That is something that I'm going to be going into next week. To make a very, very long story very short, what Hitler said was, and of course his audience was the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, mm-hmm. a bunch of industrial high rollers who were only too receptive to this message, but it was what could perhaps almost be viewed as a quasi-Calvinist approach. He said to the assembled industrialists that democracy itself was inherently subversive because you, meaning the industrialists, enjoy your superior position in society because you are superior individuals. You have more ability, and that's why you have risen to the state you have risen to. That's why I call it quasi-Calvinist, in a sense. Mm-hmm. He then went on to say, but if you allow people democracy...
They were the elect, yeah.
Exactly. If you allow people democracy, they will use that democracy to effect a redistribution of wealth, and that would be unhealthy for society because it is counter-evolutionary, not counter-revolutionary, mm-hmm. but counter-evolutionary, right. And that therefore it's bad, and he then went on to equate. And in so many words, democracy with communism, and it was that speech which convinced most of the industrialists and financiers of Germany to back Hitler and the Nazi Party rather than some of the other reactionary parties of Germany. That is
right.
A point I'll be going into next week.
And so many American academics today do the opposite. They say nothing about the political economy of Nazism. They say nothing about Hitler's appeals to the big German capitalists. And they they just look at certain forms. Well, the Nazis had big parades, the communists had big parades, they both had authoritarian states, and they were, and this theme now today is that Nazism and communism are just two totalitarian twins.
Mm-hmm.
And that's simply, both of which have victimized capitalism. That's simply not true. That Nazism, and the example you give of the Dusseldorf talk is a good one. Am I not correct that, David, that it was at that 1931 meeting that they decided to really start giving him funds in a big way? Weren't they looking him over to see? And he was very charming and reassuring, and it was then he got that enormous amount of money. And from 31 to 33, the Nazis were able to wage mass campaigns, and their votes went up rather dramatically. As he said, we had cars and loudspeakers and radio programs and reached every township in Germany, and it was exciting. We had tremendous amounts of funds, I thought, and a lot of that came from those guys. And wasn't it from that meeting, or at least
exactly.
One like it earlier?
It was from that meeting. It was a critical event in the rise of German mm-hmm. fascism, and it's one which has great relevance for a contemporary political audience. Although not a Marxist myself, I have focused on many of the same things that you have been speaking about, and as I attempt to bring to a modern audience an awareness, an historical awareness of what fascism is, why it is that in 1993 I'm talking about events that on Memorial Day, of course, which commemorates America's dead in foreign wars, the largest of which was World War II, in which many American financiers and industrialists backed the fascist powers of Europe. In fact, they tried to stage a coup in 1934 here to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt in attempting to explain...
It was something which most Americans don't even know about. That was when they tried to persuade General Smedley Butler of the U.S. Marines to come in and move on it. Isn't that what you're talking about?
Exactly.
Yeah. I have the congressional hearing report on that.
The McCormick-Dickstein Committee?
Yes, the McCormick-Dickstein. And it was it itself was censored. There are a few things from it that Lawrence Spivak, the journalist at the time, wrote down verbatim, and which never got into the final report, and they implicated J.P. Morgan and a number of other people, and McCormick's argument was, well, we had no proof of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that I got to laugh at that. If in these congressional committee reports you only put in stuff that where you had absolute proof, you'd have a lot less printing for the government printing office, I would say. But in this case, they were suddenly getting, they got very nervous and wouldn't even. So here you have these guys could actually pull something like this
mm-hmm.
and go unpunished and unmentioned in the reports, even though Butler himself fingered the Morgan interests as being behind the ones who made the overture. They were pretty stupid to approach him because he was a very honest, very populist, and very much for the men in the ranks. In fact, that's why they picked him, because he was so popular among the Marines and among armed groups, and they thought he could lead them in. And their view was to leave Roosevelt in, and Butler would come along and really wield the real power because of the crisis situation, and they'd be like a cooperative government, a junta and a president at the same time. And it was they picked the wrong man, however, he blew the whistle on them.
Mm-hmm. And what's one of the 34 coup attempt and the McCormick-Dickstein Committee and Smedley Butler and also General Douglas MacArthur, himself the son-in-law of a key Morgan aide named Edward Stotesbury, the original first choice to lead the coup, mm-hmm. Are going to be among the focal points of that part of next week's discussion. It's interesting, Dr. Parenti, to look back in history and see that whitewashed congressional report. Perhaps as many of us feel frustration about things like the Iran-Contra investigation, which was so badly curtailed, it is certainly not something that's new.
No, it isn't. The function of these kinds of investigations are to... they're to... It's really not quite to whitewash. It's to... I think you'll agree with this. It's to give the impression that the system is self-cleansing and self-correcting. Oh, there's a scandal, there's a problem here, we'll look into it. In the course of doing that, they do come up with some names and some people and some of the stuff surfaces. But at the same time, the other half of their task is to not go too far and dig too much of the muck. So there is a process of uncovering some things and covering up other things, and it's going on simultaneously. And I find that kind of fascinating. Of course, and the media is right there obligingly doing it along with them. For instance, I think the greatest single act of cover-up in the Iran-Contra affair, I said it at the time, too, was the failure of the committee to call Vice President George Bush before them. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I think he was up to it in his ears and had some very special links to, and operations he was doing. So you have this process of uncovering but and yet cover up at the same time. Would that be a fair thing to say?
I think so. The Germans have a term called Verharmlosung, which means rendering harmless. And to a certain extent, those investigations do that. If something troublesome comes along, whether it's our government dealing directly with terrorists and importing cocaine and forming contingency plans to set up martial law and round up tens of thousands, perhaps even millions of people, all of these features of the Iran-Contra investigation, it is necessary, I would maintain, I suspect you would agree, mm-hmm. that you can't allow the American people to be left with that impression of American society, that you have to point out that, well, although there are people who want to do things like that, eventually, just as one sees in the movies and in fantasy entertainment, the good guys come in with their white hats and round up the bad guys, and if they don't kill them, then they certainly put them in prison, and everything and everybody lives happily ever after.
Yeah, the American people are certainly, I guess, discouraging the degree to which some of my compatriots can be taken in at times. But polls over the last 20 years do show a remarkable decline in people's acceptance of existing institutions. You know, that say, like, what institutions do you put your faith in or which do you trust and all that. And the trust levels for the military, the federal government in general, the Congress, the media, the business leaders, the religious leaders, the trust levels for all of them have gone down rather dramatically. The problem is people don't really quite see, you know, what the alternative is, you know. My investigation shows that a lot of what's called political apathy is really just political cynicism and discouragement, that people are not, it's really antipathy that turns into apathy. And because people just get disgusted and turned off.
Mm-hmm.
And this system does not turn out mass numbers of conservative activists. You don't have mass numbers of conservatives marching in the streets and saying, more tax cuts for the rich, get rid of Social Security, and this, that, and the other thing. What it does turn out in great numbers is apolitical people, apathetical people, cynical people, a lot of them just really genuinely apolitical. I mean, they're just distracted by the puffery and the distractions of the consumer culture and mass TV and all that stuff, which, by the way, I don't think is really apolitical. I shouldn't say that. I wrote a book a while ago called Make Believe Media, The Politics of Entertainment, where I argued that many of our so-called entertainment films, that you're being much more than just entertained when you watch them. They're filled with imageries of militarism and authoritarian power and racist and sexist themes and all and anti-working class themes all through them. But there are people who are just genuinely totally uninformed. Ahistorical would be the other thing, which is why I think your tapes also are so valuable. And as you were just saying, people... the usual word is that people are bored by history, and oh, just a lot of dates, isn't that? When you make history relevant to them, when they suddenly realize that what you're talking about from 40, 50, 200 years ago are dynamics which are obtaining to this day right now, they realize that what they are experiencing are not just the peculiarities of this or that personality or some epiphenomenal thing, but that there are these larger forces going on, and they want to, and larger and repeatable forces, and they suddenly get very interested and want to know more about them, which is why, indeed, the study of fascism is very relevant, or the study of tyranny in any society is relevant, because we always face that danger today.
The media and the role of the media is actually something that directly inspired the work that I'm doing here. I determined a significant gap between what could be determined from the responsible historical record and the average, the awareness of the average American, and so undertook to establish, in a sense, my own outlet for information to do what I personally can to correct that. One of the individuals upon whose work I've relied for much of the historical record of fascism, an individual whose work I will feature next week, and an individual who's also done a lot of writing on the role of the media, the printed
George
press.
George Seldes?
Precisely.
Uh-huh.
And his works for, such as The Lords of the Press, You Can't Print That, Tell the Truth and Run. He is, in many ways, I view as the godfather or the progenitor of modern American investigative journalism. And he's done a lot of work on, in addition to fascism itself, how the media themselves fit into the larger picture of the corporate state, both abroad and in the United States. Indeed, in my discussion of Mussolini's corporate state, I relied heavily on not only on George Seldes, but on his accounts of how the American media covered up for American finance, who were instrumental in supporting Mussolini, and how despite the fact that Mussolini's corporate state was a dismal failure, it was portrayed in the American media as a marvelous success.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do you see the media, to a certain extent you've already answered this question, but media concentration, media ownership, and political reaction in this country, I think, are inextricably linked. I wonder if you could comment on that, and where do you see that relationship going in the future?
Well, it's, again, it's not quite a lapdog, and it's not, and it's certainly not the watchdog of democracy that they pretend themselves to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a frisky house pet that will occasionally nip at the leader's heels, but then wag its tail and let you know it was really nothing for real. And at other times, it's a downright raging cheering section. The media are, the Iraq War saw them as just cheering section for the military, and the military should have paid them for the job they did. It's very good. This media is very clever at giving the impression of false alternatives. I mean, one thing that happens with people in countries where the press is state controlled and censored is they know it's state controlled and censored, and there's no, you know, they knew that in Russia and all, and there was no question about it. But a lot of people do think we have a free and independent media in this country because, you know, they'll see something on the air and there'll be one guy talking for the policy, another one talking against it, but it'll always be within a very limited framework and no one ever raising, for instance, the kinds of questions that we do. This kind of discussion can be heard on very relatively small media and radio and such, but we could never be addressing audiences of 10 or 15 million on a major network and discuss this kind of thing this way. I mean, I've been on major network TV shows, but it's so structured that you have three conservatives screaming at you, you know, from different directions, and you get out, you're lucky if you get out a few sentences, and then if you do try to get into something, it's so totally out of context that it sounds completely at odds with anything that the program is considering to be true or not. So the media, as I've said before, are not close to corporate America, and they're not friendly to corporate America. They are corporate America. They're an integral part of it. I mean, NBC is owned by General Electric, and you can go on. I mean, CBS is a big international, multinational corporation, and the like. And their role continues to be that of representing the interests. I think there's such a compatibility between them and government is because both the media elites and the government elites represent the same class interests, and so they operate pretty much together on these things.
It's interesting and to me grotesque to hear the constant right-wing harping about the liberal news media. I mean, if the news media are liberal, I've missed something somewhere along the line.
Yeah, I agree, and of course, for the very far right, the news media might still be a little bit too liberalish for them. They would like them to be, you know, really even farther over. I mean, occasionally the media, to maintain its legitimacy, does report, you know, this scandal or that, the Iran-Contra, something's wrong here, or a toxic waste dump or an oil spill or the unemployment figures have gone up or, you know, these things. And if the far right had their way, none of that stuff would be reported. I mean, their idea of a good media is one that just had constant celebrations of the wonders of the free enterprise system and anti-communist horror stories and, you know, and then a lot of puffery. And by the way, a lot of stations and a lot of newspapers fit that description, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it is kind of odd that they would talk about the liberal bias in the media when, in fact, if you're a conservative commentator like a Rush Limbaugh or Evans or Novak or William Buckley, John McLaughlin has three television shows on the air. William Buckley has one. and is often on every other night on something else. I mean, almost all your pundits and commentators are either far right-wing or moderately conservative or centrist. There's really nobody that's genuinely progressive and genuinely critical or left in the media. So to call it a liberal media is really not true. It's really a right-to-centrist media at best.
Yeah, I'm reminded of Reed Irvin of Accuracy in Media, whose organization would be more appropriately termed Inaccuracy in Media, an individual who has very strong links to the former World Anti-Communist League, also, not incidentally, an individual who a little over 6 years ago tried to drive me off the air.
No kidding.
Yeah, I was attacked by old Reed about 6 years ago. He wanted me off the airwaves. Obviously, he was unsuccessful in his efforts.
I was on a panel with Reed Irvine out at a conference at Newsday. Newsday, you know, is the newspaper out in New York City and Long Island.
Right.
And he got up and talked about how the liberal media, you know, and the left media, and I couldn't believe it. And then I said, and how his opinions weren't being brought in. I said, Reed, how many, don't you have a newspaper column? How many newspapers carry it? Isn't it about 50? And so he said, no, it's 110. And so his ego, you know, got the better of me. He was strengthening my argument.
Uh-huh.
And then I said, don't you have a radio show that goes to about, I forget the numbers now, 70? And he said, no, it's 80 stations carry my radio show. Or it was something like that, 80, 100, you know, those numbers. I said, well, how many people with a working class perspective, with a left perspective, an anti-capitalist perspective, how many people can make that claim that they've got those kind of outlets? Even a relatively moderate consumer advocate and critic like Ralph Nader, his column is carried only in about 20 little newspapers, you know, and some of them are those little weekly giveaway things. And this is a guy who's had a national name, a bigger name than Reed Irvine. And the reason is because these stations and these newspapers are all owned, but most of them are owned by rich conservatives, and they don't tolerate a different perspective. This is the way it is. The truth of the matter is that reality is leftist. That is, reality is about. It's when people say, "Is that a Marxist perspective?" I say, "Well, I don't really know what Marx really had to say about America in the late 20th century. I think he was well dead and buried over 100 years by then, but it's not a Marxist. I don't consider, when I say that that labor unions are being destroyed, that we used to have 30% of our work, or rather 40% of our workforce in unions, and today we have barely 17%, and that labor is suffering a greater and greater disadvantage and people hurting. I don't consider that a Marxist perspective. I consider that reality. I mean, that's what's just happening out there.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, the forces of multinational corporate capitalism are inseparable from the rise of fascism. That's what, as I've said before, it's one of the major themes, mm-hmm. and one of the underlying research areas of my work on the air. Dr. Parenti, what...
Could I add something on this?
Sure, sure.
You see the coziness of that same thing happening in terms of the favoritism shown toward the Croatian fascists today in Europe. That is, the dogs of war are running crazy in the media that we've got to go in and stop the terrible carnage. And by the way, there is killing going on all three sides against each other. And there, I mean, I'm quoting Warren Christopher. Even he said all three sides have been killing each other, and atrocities. But I think some of the worst atrocities have been committed by the Croatians. They now have a republic which has the Ustashi flag. I mean, it's a Nazi flag, mm-hmm. the one they used to have. Their leader, President Tudjman, is a guy who has written stuff about the desirability of cleaning Europe, cleaning the Jews out of Europe, and done stuff like this. He was invited by this government to appear at the commemoration of the Holocaust Museum in Washington,
mm-hmm.
just last month. I thought that was a sick joke. I couldn't believe that he was there. Of course, he's showing a better face these days, but none of this gets reported. And what we get are these horror stories in the media about genocide. They're throwing words around like another Holocaust and genocide. I mean, that's crazy. As Secretary General of the UN, Boutros Boutros-Ghali, made the point, He said there was more killing in one day in Luanda in Angola by the Jonas Savimbi CIA mercenaries. He didn't call them all that, but mm-hmm. I'm identifying them.
The UNITA people, right?
The UNITA people. More killing in Luanda in one day than in the entire siege of Sarajevo. As the Secretary General of the UN, Boutros Boutros-Ghali, made the point, he said there was more killing in one day in Luanda in Angola by the Jonas Savimbi CIA mercenaries. He didn't call them all that, but mm-hmm. I'm identifying them.
The UNITA people, right?
The UNITA people. More killing in Luanda in one day than in the entire siege of Sarajevo. And just today's San Francisco Examiner, I invite your listeners to look at it. There's an item there, a box item on the page. It says, the Bosnian Serbs have launched the most intense attack on Sarajevo in many months. The most intense attack. Intense fighting. And then if you read two lines down, it says, 9 lives were lost and 100 wounded. I mean, I don't want to see one life lost, and I don't want to make light of that. But the media hype is so crazy. I mean, that's hardly a major war, Holocaust. I mean, why are you throwing terms like that around, trying to hype up people to go in? Well, U.S. policy has been to break up Yugoslavia into a lot of little small right-wing republics that'll be just little European versions of banana republics that could be used any way we want.
Mm-hmm.
And the Serbs have been resisting that. The Bosnian Muslim Croatians broke away from the Yugoslavia, and now the Bosnian Serbs want to break away from Bosnia. I mean, it's like when Virginia seceded from the Union, then West Virginia seceded from Virginia. Again, I'm not making heroes out of the Serbs. They have been doing some dirty things themselves. I mean, they're no heroes of mine, but I do not see, and I wish people on the left would really understand that a government that gave us El Salvador, a government that backs the Indonesian fascists in East Timor, a government like ours that is able to destroy a country like Iraq, to do all these things, that national security state is not going to go into Europe just for purely humanitarian reasons. If we go in without firepower and all that, we'll kill more people in a week than that war has killed in a year.
It's also worth noting that the U.S. national security establishment has incorporated and actively supported the residual of the Croatian fascists in the post-World War II period. The Galen spy organization, originally Hitler's Eastern Front spy organization during World War II, jumped to the CIA, became the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and ultimately wound up as the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the BND, the West German, now German intelligence service, which it is to this day.
Is his first name Reinhard?
Reinhard Galen.
Reinhard Galen, yeah.
That organization has been one of the major focal points of my research, going all the way back, about 20 years ago, when I came across many of the Galen alumni serving at the operational level of President Kennedy's assassination. The Oswalds, to make a very long story very short, were handled certainly in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and probably in the former Soviet Union as well by members, white Russians and Eastern European fascists associated with the Galen organization. And the Croatian fascists found succor with the Galen group and in turn with the CIA and with the closely related anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, originally put together by Adolf Hitler in 1943, later evolving into a major element of the World Anti-Communist League. So that as the...
All in the family, huh?
Very much so.
Yeah, well, they certainly will be linked to each other, of course, yeah.
It's grotesque to me to see the absence of a discussion of this, not only in the American media as a whole, but as you have noted, in the progressive media as well. The absence of awareness of the role of the Croatian and Montenegrin secessions, it was Slovenian secessions, in precipitating the crisis, and the direct role played by the U.S. and Germany has thus far almost completely escaped notice, including apparently in the progressive media as well, with very few exceptions.
Very few exceptions. Most of them will not touch these conspiracies. They think conspiracy is a hokey subject, and they're very mistaken. Conspiracies are the other instrument used by the national security state to carry out its functions of maintaining that kind of power and concentration of wealth. They use legitimating functions, propaganda, media, lies, all sorts of things. They'll run candidates in elections. They'll also kill and plan and plot and conspire. And to think they wouldn't do it is really the strange view. To think there aren't conspiracies in the face of Watergate, in the face of Iran-Contra in the face of the SNL scandal, which the Justice Department itself called a thousand conspiracies of theft, bribery, and fraud. A thousand conspiracies. There are conspiracies all the time, and our leaders conspire, they lie. To think otherwise is to think that they don't pursue their own interests, that they always tell the truth, that they got nothing to hide. They themselves said they have plenty to hide. They call it national security, they call it top secret, you know, covert action. They admit every day that they don't want this to get out, they don't want that to get out. We've had to have a Freedom of Information Act to get little scraps and bits out of them. And then for people to turn around and say, there are no conspiracies, they aren't hiding anything. What you see is what you're getting. What you're getting is all there is really rather naive. And apparently there are some people, even in alternative media, who don't seem to have much of an alternative perspective on that. David, you're a much younger man than I am, and I'm getting a bit tired, so maybe you'll let me go now, okay? I've really enjoyed this.
All righty. I was wondering if I could wring one more question out of you, though.
Okay, sure.
All righty, because you've already touched directly on this. One of the major points that I have made over the years is that there is a continuity between U.S. national security operations abroad and at home. You have already discussed your view, which I subscribe to, of the third worldization, to coin a phrase, of America. Where do you see national security policy inside of the country going in light of that third worldization?
Well, I think that continual repressive measures, surveillance, red squads and the local police, the local police forces of various cities. I mean, I know I'm under surveillance. I get my picture, when I was in Washington, I get my picture taken by some plainclothes guy, who I do not believe was FBI. I believe he's with the Washington, D.C. Police Red Squad. My phone gets tapped. These kinds of things go on all the time. So they're still doing all of that stuff. There's still plenty of the McCarthyism. People with any kinds of left affiliations, outspokenly or high visibility, rarely can get any kind of access to strategic institutional jobs. I mean, even the civilian sector. Forget government or military and the media and such. So they do surveillance of labor union organizers. These are all Americans. Peace organizers, people who are fighting for environmental rights, are called eco-terrorists, and they come under surveillance. And people who are fighting for decent things are treated like criminals, and all the criminals are treated like the great leaders of society. And thanks to people like you, we'll keep our own listenership alerted to those kinds of things. So what we got to do is not mourn, but organize. Organize, educate, agitate, and fight back. Thanks a lot, Dave.
All righty. Before you leave, Dr. Prendi, I wonder if you could perhaps give out the post office box, phone number, et cetera, and tell interested listeners where they could learn more about your work and access your work, both tapes, perhaps, lectures, and some of your articles and books.
I can do that, and I've just switched to a cordless phone, so
okay.
I can get over to where I have that material.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I was about to go madly fiddling around the board here for the change in tone. But
did you hear the change in tone?
Oh, very, very dramatically, yeah.
I'm sorry, I'll
You could still come across loud and clear, but I noticed suddenly you sounded different. I was wondering, gosh, which button do I hit here?
Okay, hold on. Hello, is that okay?
That works fine, yeah.
People could get, you can get a flyer, a brochure, which lists all my tapes. It'll be sent to you free from People's Video. And People's Video is P.O. Box 99514. That's 99514, Seattle, Washington. The zip code is 98199. A lot of nines out here in the West.
98199?
Yeah. Or easier, you could always call People's Video at 206-789-5371, and they will send you a flyer, and you can or send you any tapes you want. She'll read the list of tapes to you.
Okay, now, you have authored many books and articles as well. What are some of the titles and the publishers that interested listeners can pursue on that you've authored?
Okay, well, I just had a new book out. Well, really not new, but a second edition is called Inventing Reality, The Politics of News Media, which goes into some of the things we were talking about, how the media distorts both domestic political and U.S. foreign policy life. I have another book called Democracy for the Few, which is a critical, radical analysis of the whole American democratic system and political economy. And I have another book called The Sword and the Dollar, which is about imperialism and revolution and struggles in the Third World and U.S. policy relating to them. And another called Make Believe Media, The Politics of Entertainment. And I'll have a book coming out in August called Land of Idols, which is about political mythology in America. I've just given you the last six or seven that are still in print or coming into print.
All righty. Well, that will give interested listeners plenty to chew on, I'm sure.
Okay.
I will repeat the address, phone number, et cetera, for people's video later on in the broadcast.
Well, thanks a lot.
All righty. Well, it's a pleasure, Dr. Parenti. I would like to...
Could I also add that those tapes are also, like yours, they are sold... Not for profit. I don't make any money in people's video, don't we? Sell them at cost. I think they cost only $4 a tape.
Okay. Right. Very good. I'd like to invite you back at some point in the future, Dr. Parenti, when your schedule permits. I'd be interested to pursue one of the lines of debate that has occurred within the progressive political community in recent months, that of, quote, institutional versus, quote, conspiratorial analysis. And in particular, you had, I thought, a very intelligent exchange with Noam Chomsky, one of the foremost figures in the progressive political community, an individual I'm bitterly critical of. And the whole subject of American political assassinations and why it is not politically correct to talk about those, which I personally see as almost a form, and not almost, but really a form of no Holocaust theory. It didn't really happen. And I'd like to take that up when we have the time to do that in the future.
Okay, we will.
Okay.
Well, thank you. And that tape you're going to do, let me return the favor. How does one get hold of the one you're going to do Memorial Day on? Fascism.
All of the archive shows that I've produced. And
I've got that brochure. I can just call them, right?
You can call them. And, in fact, next week I'm going to be rebroadcasting Uncle Sam and the Swastika, originally done in May of 1980, with some addenda that have been done recently, including one done last year, talking about George Bush's family and their relationship to the same transatlantic financial and industrial axis that supported Hitler. I'm going to be talking about Uncle Sam and Il Duce, the tape that you've heard, talking about American support for Mussolini and the mythology of American of the corporate state. We're going to be talking about the 34 coup attempt next week. Going to be talking about corporate links between Japanese fascism and America. And also I'm going to be analyzing in detail and actually reading long extracts from Hitler's speech to the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, in which he basically said democracy is subversive, something we touched on earlier.
Right. Very good.
All righty.
Okay, good talking to you.
All righty. Thanks so much,
bye-bye.
Dr. Parenti.